Ukraine and Russia.
Part 3.
NATO has expanded into 13 countries up to the borders of Russia. 13 countries.
The focus has to be on not allowing this crisis to turn into hot war between Ukraine and Russia.
Ukraine. It's an ancient and proud land with a rich history filled with much beauty, heroism, and sacrifice. Ukraine is a borderland, a place where east meets west. This is the flag of Ukraine. The blue represents the sky, the gold its seemingly endless fields of wheat. Ukraine is a prize many have sought, and much blood has spilled in the quest to possess it. Ukraine has been the pathway for Western powers as they attempted to conquer the East. The people's growing discontent made Ukraine more vulnerable to outside forces, and a new kind of warfare was launched, one not known before, the Color Revolutions.
An NGO is a non-governmental organization. Now, many NGOs are quite legitimate. They represent good causes. Maybe they help people in a country feed or deal with water problems or deal with various kinds of social problems. But there are some NGOs that have become funded by government entities and serve more the purpose of that government rather than trying to serve the people that they are ostensibly working for. One thing we saw in the 1980s, at that point, the Central Intelligence Agency had been largely discredited because of scandals that had been exposed in the 1970s.
November 30th of 2013 became the first turning point of Euromaidan and one of its most reported and mysterious events. Incidentally, one such organization, Hromadske TV, received generous donations from the Dutch and U.S. embassies, as well as from the Renaissance Foundation, an NGO founded by George Soros.
I set up a foundation in Ukraine before Ukraine became independent of Russia. And the foundation has been functioning ever since. And it played an important part in events now.
Any good director will tell you that tempo and rhythm are the most essential components to hold an audience's attention. It can also be called a method of betrayal when the allies and followers are relentlessly thrown into the revolutionary flame. The idea is simple. When the preparation work is done, the trigger just needs to be pulled to set the machine into full motion. The murder of politician Rafik Hariri led to the Cedar Revolution. Looking back at the mysterious poisoning of Viktor Yushchenko right before the Orange Revolution of 2004, we see now that he became a sacred victim himself. Most political analysts believe the compassion of the Ukrainian people at that moment tilted the scales, giving him the presidency. Like in 2004 during the Orange Revolution, international leaders felt it necessary to intervene and bring both sides to the negotiating table.
Приехали три министра иностранных дел европейских стран в Киев.
Laurent Fabius, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, Radoslav Sikorsky.
The Ukrainian president and the leaders of the anti-government protests there have agreed on a truce.
The truce was to give talks between President Yanukovych and the opposition a chance.
Just like in 2004, the opposition, or at least its radical faction, the Right Sector, headed by Dmitry Yarosh, had no intention on fulfilling its part of the bargain.
The opposition leaders left saying they may have found a way to end the bloodshed, but they wanted to take the conclusions from their meeting to the people.
it was soon apparent that the people were not happy.
At the same time, Kiev was saying its last goodbyes to the victims of the massacre. It was also welcoming those who came to power at their cost.
Ukraine's parliament has voted for the new speaker of the assembly to become interim president. Alexander Turchynov called on lawmakers to form an interim government by Tuesday. These latest developments follow the dismissal of President Viktor Yanukovych on Saturday.
And they removed Yanukovych, not following the constitutional procedures for impeachment.
The Parliament of Ukraine consists of 450 deputies. The Constitution of Ukraine requires at least a three-fourths majority to vote. In other words, 338 votes in favor of the impeachment, but only 328 deputies voted yes.
The U.S. State Department almost immediately said this was a legitimate government, and that was part of this effort to get regime change. Instead of trying to find some way to revive the February 21st agreement, where maybe you could bring back Yanukovych in some titular way, that became not a possibility anymore. Then you had eastern Ukraine resisting, you had Crimea wanting to break away, and things rapidly escalated.
Voters will decide Sunday whether they'll leave Ukraine and join Russia.
The campaign with the slogan, "Together with Russia," has the backing of Moscow.
Crimean authorities, sensing the mood of the populace, fully supported Viktor Yanukovych's decision to postpone the 2013 European Union Association deal and side deeper ties to Russia. As the events in Kiev took their course, Crimean authorities issued a declaration, putting into words the fears of its people. Based on the will of the Crimeans who elected us, we declare that we will not give Crimea to extremists and neo-Nazis seeking to seize power in Ukraine at the cost of the blood of the country and its citizens. After the regime change in Kiev, rumors began spreading in Crimea that the new authorities would be merciless to those that opposed them.
Slava Ukraini!
This led to the pro-Russian demonstrations rejecting the new government in Kiev. On February 27th, the government buildings in the capital of Crimea were seized by pro-Russian protesters. The current Crimean government was dismissed, and the new leader, Sergei Aksyonov, was assigned as the leader of the Crimean Autonomous Republic. On March 16th, the Crimean referendum was held, and the people voted to leave Ukraine and enter the Russian Federation.
The situation in Crimea is being presented as a Russian invasion. And again, nobody who looks at this seriously and looks at the poll numbers, some of the poll numbers done by the U.S. government agencies themselves, showing that the people of Crimea preferred being part of Russia. In the U.S. news media, it has all been presented as the Russians invaded, they then staged a sham election with people with guns at their backs, somehow they faked the ballot boxes to get 96% approval for rejoining Russia.
The idea of a referendum in Crimea is just quite simply unconstitutional.
But it does raise questions on whether this vote really is free and fair, especially given the heavy military presence in Crimea right now, Errol.
So that's how it's been sold to the American people. The reality is very different.
The atmosphere here certainly is electric. Thousands of people who've gathered in the capital Crimean city of Simferopol, all of this following a referendum held last Sunday in which the majority of people here overwhelmingly voted in support of being reunited with Russia.
As long ago as 1804, Sevastopol's naval base became the main military port of the Russian Empire on the Black Sea. During the Second World War, the heroic defense of Sevastopol lasted almost a year and took hundreds of thousands of lives. Therefore, the naval base in Crimea has a legacy of historical pride for the Russian Black Sea Fleet, as well as being of huge strategic importance.
Those of us alive back then remember when there were Soviet missiles put into Cuba, how frightened Americans were and how angry, and how we almost went to a nuclear confrontation over having weapons of that kind of destruction placed that close to the United States.
If the United States considers Cuba to be in its backyard, then Crimea lays at Russia's doorstep. In early spring of 2014, eastern Ukraine was also buzzing with protests against the new authorities in Kiev. This region, with the population close to Russia geographically and culturally, feared that the ultra-right leanings of the newly formed government would bring neo-nationalism to their lands. And they had their reasons. The status of the Russian language in Ukraine has been a stumbling block for many years.
Implementing Russian as a second state language was one of the main campaign promises of President Viktor Yanukovych.
In 2012, the Yanukovych government passed a law making it the second official language in the southern and eastern parts of Ukraine, the areas where the Russian-speaking population makes up a majority. Ukrainian nationalist groups initiated massive protests opposing the law. An observing viewer might see some familiar faces there. On February 23, 2014, the very next day after the regime change, the new government voted for an annulment of the official status of the Russian language. And even though later this decision was vetoed by the acting president, Alexander Turchinov, it still sent a message, and a powerful one. This alarmed the Russian-speaking cities of eastern Ukraine, and people took to the streets to show their disagreement. In response, pro-Maidan groups conducted their own demonstrations. When the two parties would meet, it was always tense, and eventually it led to tragedy. One person died and over 50 people were wounded in clashes during a pro-Russian march protesting the new government in Kiev. On April 6th, the Crimean scenario began repeating in eastern Ukraine, where protesters seized government buildings. And the next day, April 7th, they proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic. Kiev replied by announcing the beginning of an anti-terrorist operation in eastern Ukraine. By that time, the international media was screaming about a Russian invasion in Ukraine.
Russia could now be on the verge of invading Ukraine.
But strong words stayed only in the media. The Ukrainian authorities never announced a warlike situation. Why? IMF cannot give money to countries engaged in ongoing war, Petro Poroshenko. Too much money was already invested in Ukraine to stop halfway.
We've invested over $5 billion to assist Ukraine in these and other goals that will ensure a secure and prosperous and democratic Ukraine.
Obviously, the funds had to keep coming, and the conflict had to keep going. Getting more and more bloody and deadly, as parties from both sides were using more sophisticated and lethal weapons. The world seemed too busy welcoming this new democracy in Kiev to notice what was being done as it spread its wings over the country. Many in southern Ukraine had been viewing the revolution with concern. And an anti-Maidan movement formed in the city of Odessa in early January 2014. The protesters set up their camp in front of the Trade Union House, a building which would soon become a monument to a massacre of its own. It's difficult to overestimate the importance of Odessa. It is strategically located on the Black Sea, and it's Ukraine's largest seaport. It's not surprising that Ukraine's new authorities were watching the situation unfolding there with growing alarm. More and more of Odessa's people were joining the anti-Maidan movement at the same time as events in eastern Ukraine were heating up. The new Ukrainian government didn't have the power to wage war on too many fronts. If Odessa were to join the growing uprising in the eastern regions, it would seriously complicate the situation. This rebellion had to be extinguished immediately and at any cost, and that cost was high. On May 2, 2014, soccer fans flocked to the center of Odessa City for the Ukrainian championship match. Surprisingly, A great number of these fans who descended into Odessa just the night before also turned out to be fighters from the Maidan self-defense units, along with members of radical organizations from all parts of Ukraine. These fans, masked, armed, and shouting nationalist mottos, began disturbances in the center of the city as they marched to the anti-Maidan tent encampment, where they attacked. The anti-Maidan protesters sought shelter in the trade union house, but it was a trap. Maidan supporters started throwing Molotov cocktails into the building until it was engulfed in flames. People burned to death inside, or, trying to escape, jumped from the windows. Although a fire station was less than a mile away, it took almost half an hour for firefighters to arrive. When they finally did, the damage had been done. But here's an intriguing fact. Just a few days before those dreadful events, a messenger from Maidan, Andriy Peruby, made a visit to Odessa. It's an interesting coincidence that some of the people he met with in Odessa were seen at the scene that fateful day. But not everyone was mourning. On the popular political talk show, Schuster Live, the news about the people burnt alive in Odessa was welcomed with a long round of applause. On its Facebook page, the right sector announced the events of May 2nd, a proud moment in national history. An official investigation into this sad event has been going on now for nearly 2 years, and it's yet to reach a conclusion. But it seems the experts had all the information they needed from the very beginning. It looks like Odessa really is a very important piece of real estate, as it was honored with a very special new governor appointed on May 30th of 2015. Mikhail Saakashvili, an old friend of the United States and born and raised in Ukraine's neighboring country, Georgia.
A little hoedown there in Georgia.
A quick look at his biography gives one an understanding that he's been groomed for a special mission. Mr. Saakashvili received a U.S. State Department scholarship, and he worked for a New York law firm which represented the organization Kamara, a group that appeared earlier when we learned about the color revolutions.
We are dealing with democratic, bloodless revolution.
This is the Revolution of Roses. And this is Mikhail Saakashvili with Kamara, busy overthrowing the legitimately elected president, Eduard Shevardnadze. Soon after the Rose Revolution blossomed fully, Georgia announced its intentions to join NATO and plant fresh NATO military bases in the fertile soil right on Russia's border.
Never ever we will give our freedom and independence. Never ever will give any piece of our territory.
Saakashvili's mission was accomplished, at least with his friends and NATO. The Georgian populace wasn't quite as happy, though. In 2007, they took to the streets to voice discontent, and Mr. Saakashvili responded with force. The people's discontent grew. Saakashvili's party lost parliamentary elections, and the opposition took control.
He said, "This means that the parliamentary majority should set up a new government and me as the president, according to our constitution."
Mikhail decided not to wait for the results of the president's election and fled the country in October 2013. In 2014, Saakashvili refused summons to appear in court as a witness in several criminal cases. Later that same year, he was accused of misuse of power and embezzlement. Saakashvili wound up in the U.S., and soon his friends in Washington found him a new assignment. Mikhail actively supported Maidan, and very soon was rewarded with a high position in the new Ukrainian government. First as the president's counselor, and then as the governor of Odessa. The day before taking this position, he renounced his citizenship to Georgia, the country of his birth, and became a Ukrainian citizen. As they say, the battle is worth the blood, both literally and figuratively. Jeffrey Pyatt, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, paid a visit to Saakashvili just a month after he took office in Odessa.
But as long as the Oblast administration is delivering results on Ukraine, you are going to see a steady flow of embassy and Washington visitors coming here.
The meeting was fruitful, and Jeffrey generous. No matter how well Saakashvili's job goes, it looks like he shouldn't be worried about his own finances. On his Facebook page, he posted an official document showing that the new governor of Odessa gets a pretty penny from Washington, almost $200,000 a year. For comparison, the governor of Maine gets $70,000 a year. So if Odessa became a new U.S. state, it would be at the top of the list. Mr. Saakashvili should feel right at home in his newly adopted country. He is best of friends with fellow color revolutionary leader Viktor Yushchenko, who's the godfather of his son. A war, once launched, doesn't choose its victims.
We are just learning at this hour that Malaysian Airlines has now confirmed that it has lost contact with one of its planes.
The plane was indeed shot down by a missile while flying at a high altitude over eastern Ukraine near the Russian border.
298 revised number of souls on board, all feared dead.
It was a murder. It was a crime. There's been this odd nonchalance about pursuing the answers. There was a report, a very limited report, put out a few months after the event. But since then, they said the next report will be on the first anniversary of the event. But you deal with a criminal investigation before it becomes a cold case. So there's been this curious element of why is there not greater pressure from both the media and the Western governments to answer these questions.
But even without any answers, the fingers were pointed immediately.
That's not an accident. That is happening because of Russian support. Evidence indicates that the plane was shot down by a surface-to-air missile that was launched from an area that is controlled by Russian-backed separatists inside of Ukraine.
The Malaysian Boeing wasn't the first plane to play a significant part in American-Russian relationships. On September 1st, 1983, Korean Airlines Flight 007 from New York to Seoul via Anchorage was shot down by a Soviet interceptor aircraft over the territory of the USSR in the Sea of Japan.
There was absolutely no justification, either legal or moral, for what the Soviets did.
The tragedy of the Korean Boeing was considered a perfect occasion to demonstrate the NATO military power within dangerous proximity to the Soviets. On November 2nd, 1983, NATO launched Able Archer, a 10-day command post exercise simulating a conflict escalation, culminating in a nuclear attack. It was followed by placing Pershing II nuclear missiles in Europe. What Reagan didn't take into consideration was the paranoid overreaction of the Soviets. A recently declassified U.S. intelligence report shows that for the first time since the Cuban Missile Crisis, the world was that close to nuclear war. Just like in 1983, the Malaysian Boeing crash was leveraged against the enemy. A new wave of sanctions hit Russia immediately after the tragedy.
The United States is imposing new sanctions in key sectors of the Russian economy.
Almost a year and 3 months later, the Dutch Safety Board published a report.
Ladies and gentlemen, flight MH17 crashed because of a 9N314M warhead detonated outside the aeroplane above the left side of the cockpit.
The report didn't blame any specific group or person and estimated a very wide area of 320 kilometers as a zone from which the missile was fired. At the same time, the Russian producer of Buk missiles, Almazante, conducted its own independent investigation. During the experiment, they blew up a retired airliner with a Buk missile and came to the conclusion that the Malaysian plane was brought down by the older type of missiles, not used by Russia anymore, but still in the possession of Ukraine. The company claims that the missile was launched from the territory controlled by the Ukrainian military. One would expect that these controversial results would again stir up public interest in the investigation, but the tragedy of Malaysian flight MH17 had already played its role in the big geopolitical game. Therefore, it was soon forgotten. The goal was achieved. After the third wave of sanctions hit Russia, the tensions between the two countries skyrocketed. So the question presents itself, Are we truly witnessing the beginning of Cold War 2.0? And if so, what are our chances to survive at this time? In 1947, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists introduced the Doomsday Clock. It represents a countdown to global nuclear annihilation. In 1953, during the height of the Cold War, it came its closest to midnight as the superpowers were creating massive nuclear arsenals.
This is the story of America's ever-expanding atomic weapons program.
As the world began to grasp the insane danger of nuclear warfare and took measures to control the arms race, the situation steadily improved. In 1991, the Doomsday Clock was at its furthest from midnight, 17 minutes. That time of hope was short-lived, though, as the world has become more and more unstable. But in 2015, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists moved the clock to just 3 minutes to midnight.
Today, unchecked climate change and a nuclear arms race resulting from modernization of huge arsenals pose extraordinary and undeniable threats to the continued existence of humanity.
The United States and Russia have embarked on massive programs to modernize their nuclear arsenals, undermining existing nuclear weapons treaties. The clock ticks now at just 3 minutes to midnight because international leaders are failing to perform their most important duty, ensuring and preserving the health and vitality of human civilization.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The limelight. In the U.S., conservatives within the Republican Party are digging in against Kevin McCarthy before the conclusion of a closed-door fight over consolidating the House GOP leader's power. As House Republicans keep debating their rules for next year's majority, the Freedom Caucus, home to several members seeking to derail Kevin McCarthy's speakership bid, is pushing for institutional changes that they argue will restore power to rank-and-file members. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Washington Post has more for us. Would-be House Speaker Kevin McCarthy appeared on Monday on Newsmax, and rather strikingly, he floated a scenario for the upcoming vote to lead the House. If we play games on the floor, the Democrats could end up picking who the Speaker is. Kevin McCarthy's allies have referenced this worst-case scenario before. The idea is that if McCarthy can't get the votes and there isn't a ready alternative, moderate Republicans could band together with Democrats to fill the void. It's a rather fanciful hypothetical, meant to persuade the caucus to unite behind McCarthy. But the fact that McCarthy felt the need to lodge this warning shot would seem to say plenty about how imperiled he views his ascent as being. And there was more in that vein on Tuesday night from McCarthy. And it doesn't come out of nowhere. McCarthy was passed over once before for House Speaker back in 2015 amid a revolt from the party's right wing. And so far, at least five House Republicans have signalled they're opposing Kevin McCarthy for Speaker. Given the GOP is likely to have a 222-213 majority, that means McCarthy could just be shy of the majority of votes he needs on 3rd of January to become Speaker. There are many variables here, including how these members might register their discontent. If they don't vote for an alternative, if they vote present, for instance, their protest votes will effectively only count half as much. A candidate doesn't need 218 votes, but rather a majority of those casting a ballot for an actual candidate. The death of Representative Donald McEachin, a Democrat from Virginia, on Monday doesn't immediately change McCarthy's math. But other members are absent or vote present, the threshold would also be lowered. But for now, it's worth drilling down on just how firm McCarthy's opponents are and what their beefs are given the manoeuvring ahead. As things stand, we count five Republicans as indicating they're against Kevin McCarthy, including two who have indicated they won't vote present. If five of these names are truly committed to actually voting against Kevin McCarthy and all Democrats cast their ballots, they could kill McCarthy's shot at becoming Speaker of the House once again. Website Salon.com has also covered the same story. Representative Andy Biggs, a Republican from Arizona who ran against House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, Republican of California, for the GOP House Speaker nomination, predicted this week that McCarthy is down roughly 20 votes, with pretty hard no's ahead of a full House vote on 3rd of January 2023. The California Republican needs to win the majority of the votes cast in January in a House in which Republicans hold a narrow majority over Democrats. Kevin McCarthy is at risk of falling short of the 218 votes necessary to secure the post if all members are present. I was told by a number of people who came after to me afterwards, who aren't members of the Freedom Caucus, that I voted for you, or I voted against Kevin. Biggs, a member of the House Freedom Caucus, said on a Conservative Review podcast. So far, at least four other House Freedom Caucus members have joined Biggs in opposing Kevin McCarthy for Speaker of the House. They are Representative Matt Gaetz of Florida, Ralph Norman of South Carolina, Bob Good of Virginia, and Ralph Norman of South Carolina have been the most vocal about being resolute in voting against Kevin McCarthy, while Matt Rosendale of Montana has suggested that he would be open to backing the California Republican if he makes significant concessions. Biggs published an opinion editorial 2 weeks ago making it clear he was a hard no when it came to voting for McCarthy. "I do not believe he will ever get to 218 votes, and I refuse to assist him in his effort to get those votes," Biggs wrote. "In the end, I must concur with my constituents. It is time to make a change at the top of the House of Representatives. I cannot vote for a gentleman from California, Mr. McCarthy." Matt Gaetz of Florida was the first one to come out against McCarthy hard before the House GOP conference chose him as its leader and nominee for Speaker of the House. I'm not voting for Kevin McCarthy, Matt Gaetz said. I'm not voting for him tomorrow. I'm not voting for him on the floor of the House. No kind of concession could change his mind about supporting McCarthy. Bob Good is also set on his vote. Asked about what McCarthy would have to do to earn his vote during an interview with Steve Bannon, Good responded, "No, sir, because we can do better." He added that several Republicans have come out publicly to oppose the California Republican, and he believes many more will join them on 3rd of January 2023 to reflect the will of the voters who sent us to Congress to make the change that's desperately needed to save the Republic. We're not going to get that with the current leadership. We have to have a new Speaker of the House. Ralph Norman of South Carolina is also standing firm in his decision to vote no. He has cited McCarthy's refusal to adopt the Republican Study Committee's plan for the budget as one of his main points of contention.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Topic that we are going to delve into today or in the upcoming episodes probably is Nazr, and that's what we are going to do according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we continue our program, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hauza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. The topic that we are talking about is Islamic Laws about vows or nazr. Sheikh Javed, you know, if an individual makes a vow or a pledge that will spend, he will spend or she will spend some money in the name of, for example, one of the infallibles, Lady Fatima, peace be upon her, or the, one of the imams, peace be upon them all, is it permissible to spend amount, the same amount to which the vow was attached, on any charitable work or any good deed in name of those people in which you have made the vow about?
Oh, that's good. Well, it is permissible to spend the money or the thing donated or about which the nazr has been made in the name of the infallibles, peace be upon them, on any charitable act or any charitable work or any good deeds, like let's say using the money to hold a mourning ceremony or a commemorative ceremony on the occasion of the martyrdom of, let's say, Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, so the money can be spent on any good deeds, because he did not specify. He said that, okay, I'm going to give some money in the name of Lady Fatima Zahra, salamullah alayha, and then, okay, the money is not cannot be given to the lady herself, but, okay, the money should be spent on good and charitable activities, like, for example, good deeds, any good deed, like one of the good deeds that can be, on which money can be, the donated money can be spent, is holding ceremonies and majalis on the occasion of the martyrdom of one of the infallible imams, of course.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, another question, Sheikh Javed, is that can an individual make a vow to do something which he or she is not capable of performing it?
Oh, that's a good question. A person can make a vow only for an act which is possible for him to fulfill or to comply with. I mean, he has the power to do it.
Right.
If, for example, a person is not capable of traveling, let's say, to Karbala, and he makes a vow that he will walk from, let's say, from India to Karbala, okay? Something which he a normal individual cannot do.
Mm-hmm.
So this vow is not binding. It's not valid, because such a person cannot walk 2,000 or 3,000 kilometers from India or Pakistan all the way to Karbala. So the vow is not valid in the first place.
Yes. Okay. Sir Shavit, someone says, I have more than one vow, right?
Yes.
For example, let's say 10 vows on me to fulfill. And I don't know whether the formula recited though at that time then to make those vows was valid. What does he or she have to do to be relieved of his or her obligation?
Well, first of all, as I said in one of the previous episodes, the formula should contain the word Allah. And if he remembers that the formula he recited contained the word Allah, then he should go ahead and fulfill the vow. And in the event that he does not remember or he has no idea whether he even recited the formula or not in the first place, then, of course, it's not obligatory for him to fulfill the vow and to do anything, because he has no idea. He's not sure whether he recited any formula or not. Then we can assume that he did not recite any formula. And there is a principle which we call the principle of istishab. So the principle of istishab, which is actually to presume the continuity of the something, indicates or suggests that individual is not under the obligation to fulfill, to do anything, because we can say that in the past Nazr was not obligatory, and now we doubt whether it is still obligatory on him or not, or it is obligatory in him upon him at all or not. Then we conclude that it is not obligatory at this time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the Library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawbid, our guest speaker. Well, the topic that we are talking about is Nazr or vow. And Sheikh Tawbid, I want to ask you this question in this part of our program Islamic Laws. If a person makes a vow that they will perform an unlawful or reprehensible act, or the other way around, if they refrain, they make a vow to refrain from a lawful or obligatory act as well as a recommended act, are their vows valid?
Well, it's a matter of +2 + 2 = 4. The answer is very clear. Because a person cannot make a vow promising or pledging to do or to commit a haram act or to perform a makruh act, you know. And a person cannot make a vow also to refrain from, you know, a wajib or a mustahab act. So the thing is that such a vow is invalid in the first place. The act that you are going to perform, and or the vow that you must that you make should include an act which has some preference according to Islamic Sharia. It's good to do, it's better to do, and then you make a vow that you will do it. In that case, the vow is valid. Otherwise, if it has no preference, and it is even haram or even makruh, or it is a kind of an act which involves refraining from something which is recommended, which is maybe wajib, so the vow cannot be valid in this case.
Mm-hmm. Sheikh Tawbid, what is the Islamic law, what is the Sharia law about an act that has an equal merit? If a vow is made to do such an act, is it obligatory? Is it mandatory to perform the very act?
Okay. I understand from your question that equal merit means that it's something neither good nor bad.
Right.
It is 50-50, you know, it's in between. So if a person makes a vow that he will perform or abandon a normal act, for example, the performing or abandoning, you know, an act which is it's neither good to perform nor bad to perform, so it has equal merits in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
So his vow is not in order, because as I said, there should be something good in it. It should have a preference. It should be preferable. Otherwise, you know, the vow is not valid. So if performing is better in some respect, and a person makes a vow to do it, to fulfill it, then it's okay, it's permissible. For example, if a person makes a vow that, okay, he will eat a certain kind of food so as to gain strength for worshiping Allah, for remaining vigilant, for let's say for rendering services to the people,
right.
His vow will be in order, because praying, worshiping is mm-hmm. good, and he has made a vow to eat food so as to remain strong. That's good.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And let's say I give another example. If a person makes a vow that he will renounce, okay. And renouncing an act is good in some respect. And for example, if he finds smoking is harmful, and he makes a vow that, okay, he not to smoke, his vow is in order, because smoking is harmful. And even if it is not harmful, it is very much likely that smoking can, let's say, result, can endanger someone's life or risk his health. So renouncing is good. And of course, if a person makes a vow to renounce smoking, then it is the vow is valid.
Okay, thank you very much, Ashtobi. Thank you very much, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. From me and the rest of the team here in this radio, we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.